The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's Saturday, June 25th, 2011, 1006 AM in the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, we're going to be talking about information, actually. We have Brian Suda on and information visualization and such. But first, Ben, welcome back. You've been abroad.
I've been abroad for 2.5 months, yes.
Well, we've missed you dearly.
Oh, I've missed you guys.
And just let me ask you, do you know what is important about 37?
37. Isn't that the ideal temperature of feeding bottles measured in centigrade?
Maybe. But no, something else.
I think it's used 4 times in the Bible, and 4 is 2 times 2.
Are you really doing this numerology thing? No, come on, something else, man.
That's not numerology. Okay, something else. The creation of the world, I think, happened 37 centuries before the birth of Jesus
Ben,
Christ.
How about something important?
Okay, fine. Numerology, right? Name number 37 is ruled by 3 and 7, which stand for Jupiter and Kethu.
Oh.
As the guru of Devas, Jupiter is gifted with divine powers, and Kethu represents high state of knowledge and dispassion. You know,
Ben, this is GeekSpeak. Okay. Related to GeekSpeak.
Okay, fine.
Think
fair
about
enough.
It.
37 is the 13th prime number. That's really lucky, right?
Okay. Something about today's date. It's
okay.
June 25th. Anything?
Let me see. The 25th of June is 6 months from Christmas. Oh, wait. Okay, I got one. So take the mark of the beast, 666. So if you take 666 and you add 6 plus 6 plus 6, you get 18. Multiply that times 37, and what do you get? You get 666 again, right?
Happy birthday, Miles. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridge the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today, as you've guessed, it is Miles Elam's birthday. Does anyone know his birthday number, his age?
666.
That's right.
It's really old.
Miles, happy birthday, man.
And I thought you were going to say
why,
Miles is
you.
The devil.
Well, he is born the 25th of June. That's exactly 6 months away.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in the air room we have, of course, Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy and Stanford instructor sometimes.
Yeah, coming up.
Yeah, okay, good. And
yourself.
Alex Lias, he is an application security analyst and our Southern correspondent, but in the air room. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Mr. Brian Suda on as well. Brian, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, certainly. We're just going to invite you to participate in our news segment. We'll be chatting with you more about data visualization and stuff later, but please feel free to jump in. You are a well-renowned geek. Alex, can you tell us well, I want to do some security news with you since you're our security expert.
All right.
You got one of these that's security related?
Oh, security, sure. I guess recently we had a web authentication certificate authority has basically suffered a breach,
mm-hmm.
A fairly major one. I didn't get too much detail in terms of who and you know all that stuff. But
what's the side effect?
The effect is that we might be seeing some fraudulent certificates going out there that actually your browser will say, hey, this is valid.
So the certificate is what produces the – when you go to HTTPS, it's an SSL certificate. You get that lock on your browser comes on.
Yep.
That infers that some security handshake has happened.
It does a couple of things. One, it tells you that the communication is encrypted. And if the certificate is validated, then it also tells you that this site is who they say they are.
Okay.
Who they're claiming to be. So it, you know, if they, it does require a bit of a complicated attack. I mean, if I'm going to try and, get somebody to think or go to something that's not Microsoft.com, but their browser says it is, I would have to also get them to go to a domain like Microsoft.com,
right,
and yet somehow route it to a server that isn't actually Microsoft's.
So there's kind of a couple layers of security. One's kind of just the way the protocol works. When you ask for Microsoft.com, you get a certain IP address and that's actually run by the Microsoft Corporation's web servers. So theoretically, unless you've gotten onto those machines, you're not really able to use much. But you could potentially also take advantage of a DSL, I mean a DNS attack, if you will.
Correct. You need to do a combo like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
But the big thing is normally when you do get that certificate from Microsoft, you have a high, and there's no error messages that occur, there's no warnings, you have a high reliability that is actually Microsoft that you're talking to. And that's part of this SSL infrastructure, if
yeah.
you will.
I mean, another quick attack I could explain, that, say you get some malware on your system, and mm-hmm. You know, people think, oh, you have malware, you're totally screwed anyway. But if you have malware, say they modify your host file,
mm-hmm.
and then you go, you know, for all your banking websites, and then you go to your banking website, you can then do authentication and login and stuff, and they can just be capturing all your
relatively simple hack of your machine, changing your host file, which basically says, hey, ignore what the internet says, this is the machine that you want to talk to.
Right, but it depends on the limited attack. I mean, if you get malware in your system, they could probably just sniff your keyboard anyways.
Right. So let me ask you, I guess that the browsers themselves kind of know which certificate authorities, which authorities to trust. And this is the issue, is that one of those ones that says, yes, that's always trusted, is not actually trusted anymore because it's been taken advantage of.
Correct. Or there's also chains. So it may be that the certificate you're going to says, well, this person certifies me. And then you look up the cert for that one, and that one's signed by one of the known roots.
Gotcha.
And that's getting to be more common. Even
it's really complicated. This idea of trust online is a very complicated problem.
Yeah.
You can't really rely on human beings to figure out the trust things, because all of the cues that we normally have, like, you know, someone's voice or being able to look at them or the things that you know about them, that all goes away. It's just a digital file that can be copied, and therefore, who knows how to trust. So it's an interesting process. Thank you so much for updating us on that. Ben, I introduced you by saying that you've been traveling a lot. Anything interesting about that?
Actually, quite a few things. Quick summary, trains are awesome, and bridges that have trains on them are awesome. Like, some of the architecture I saw was just really, really smart. I really liked it.
Don't you mean trains that work at a relatively high speed and have a really good infrastructure?
Well, Amtrak isn't a train, really, per se, right? No, I'm sorry. Sorry, Amtrak. No, but
I think Amtrak will sleep it tonight.
But London was just amazing, you know? Like, it just... How do you run a system like that?
Well, they don't have a train. They have a tube.
they're trains when they're above ground.
Important.
they're trains when they're above ground, I think.
Anyway, anything else?
I also wanted to... I found this really great podcast called Geek Speak that I listened to, and they had a really epic password show. I just wanted to say thanks, guys, for doing that.
That was
really
Miles
good.
Was on that show. That was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of talking for two people, and you know, somehow you managed
to... No, we had calls.
Yeah,
and
we did.
And they
ended up
asking about passwords.
Hey, so. The password show is fantastic. You got to listen to it. You can find it at geekspeak.org. As you can find every... Well said. Good said.
Good said.
You can find anything we talk about on Geekspeak up at geekspeak.org, assuming the site is running. Which I didn't test today.
Anyway, I also wanted to talk a bit about language. Because, well, as everyone knows, Europe has a lot more languages than North America does, or at least languages that are well spoken. And so I was traveling all around, and I ended up learning actually quite a bit of German, not enough to say anything on the air and not get a flood of complaints about pronunciation. But I actually found a story about language, and I found it very interesting because I was just learning a language. So basically, they did this study, and this is going to be published in Psychology Science, an upcoming issue. And this is done this is going to be published in the Journal of the Association for Psychological Science. And the study said, showed that they took all these people who were Chinese, or at least Chinese was their mother tongue, right?
Mm-hmm.
And each person was shown a pair of words, and the first word was flashed on the computer screen very quickly, the people didn't realize they had seen it. And the second word appeared for longer, and you're supposed to hit a key and indicate whether the word that you're being shown, the English word that you're being shown, is a word or not. And all of these people in the study, they spoke Chinese as their mother language, but English was, like, they were very, very good at English, right? So they were fluent in English. So here was the trick. Even though everything in the test was English, sometimes they had two English words that had no connection in English, but they had a connection in Chinese. And so the example that they gave is the word thing and the word west, where in English there's nothing really between, there's no connection between those words. But if you look at it in Chinese, thing has two characters and west has one, and that character that's in west also appears in thing.
Okay.
So if you speak Chinese, there is a connection there. The really cool
there's a setup for a pun in there if you speak Chinese.
Sure,
you can use the west.
Maybe,
and the,
I'll,
man,
bet, I'll bet, yeah,
delicious.
There's probably many jokes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I wouldn't know, but... anyway, this is what the study found. When the two words shared characters in Chinese, people processed these words faster even though the entire study and everything about the study was in English, which indicates that probably these people are actually translating what they see in English into Chinese to understand it, as opposed to just thinking in English. So my questions that I have...
Well, but isn't it also possible that the structures in the brain are such that those thoughts are processed in a similar area?
Yeah, like possibly.
Actually, it's a common thing with people who are bilingual that they'll have what's called a second voice. Mm-hmm. That's almost like a second personality. One, the side that speaks, for example, you were bilingual in English and Spanish, you have one part of your brain that speaks in English, another part that speaks in Spanish, and they're not necessarily the same thing. It's not like... I'm talking about people who are fully bilingual, not people who are still in the learning process that are translating in their head, that you actually kind of switch off one to work on the other. It's also one of the reasons why when people get older, you're less likely to suffer the visual effects of Alzheimer's if you are bilingual. Because you actually have more active neurons working in those different areas. You have a redundancy system.
Does this study make sense in that kind of idea of how bilingual works, Miles? Because it sounds like in this study, there's some connection from the two brains, if you will.
There is. You make associations as you learn those different languages. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's... The individuals they may translate in their head. It usually that will happen if someone has their primary language and they've gotten better at the second language, but they learned it later.
There's also an interesting thing about this study is that you're asking them, "Is that an English word?" And therefore, you're giving them cognitive foci on language, right? You're telling their brain to think about language, which is different than how we normally deal with language.
Yeah, but you're not asking them really anything about what the word means or what the word is or anything behind it. Just recognizing, oh, that's a word and that's not a word, you know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting that there is a connection. And I'm sure, you know, of course there's assuming that, one study, so take it with a grain of salt.
Do they only do words that have direct translations?
You mean
in the study? You can have a word in a language that doesn't have a translated word.
I assume so. I didn't read anything about that specifically, I mean, my questions that this brings up for me is this just for languages that are completely dissimilar? Like, you know, Chinese and English are completely dissimilar. There's really no overlap there, except for maybe with words pertaining to electronics. You know, because it's will this be found eventually to be the case for language in general, or is this just for specific languages or languages that have certain relationships? And then the other thing is, I found myself feeling like I was thinking a little bit in German. Even though I know very little German, I felt like I was thinking in German, right? When I was learning Spanish in high school, I felt like I was thinking in Spanish for a little period of time, and I'm not great at Spanish either. So how much can we trust our brains that we're actually thinking in this language? Are we actually just doing this overhead of translating back and forth without being conscious of it? It's really interesting stuff.
I'm actually reminded of, believe it or not, a Lauryn Hill song, or it's actually with the Fugees, but anyway, that's a whole side bit.
Come on.
We're talking about... a woman getting ahead and says she turns dinero into dinera. And at the same time, dinero, Spanish for money. Dinera is not a Spanish word. And yet, many times in English, we have learned, you know, the course of, there's masculine and feminine in Spanish, and if dinero is men's money, then dinera would be women's money. But it's something, it's an association that a Spanish speaker may not make.
Right.
But it would be someone, if you're an English speaker and you know just that little bit of Spanish, that just like brought it to mind.
Yeah.
Some way to get it into people's heads so that it's not just a Chinese-English thing that many people may not have a strong association with.
Right. Miles, you're not in the same wiki we are, so I don't know what your next news story is, but it's your birthday, so do anything you'd like.
We covered a while back that... Google and Stanford were planning on having some trials to have autonomous cars driving around in Nevada.
Right.
Well, the law has been passed.
Really?
Yes. Nevada has passed a law authorizing cars without a driver on their roads.
What? Really?
Yep.
Wait, what state?
Is that...
Nevada.
Remind me not to go to Nevada.
The Department of Transportation.
Is it just some roads?
Actually, do you know this one, Alex?
No, I don't. No. I'm going to leave you to it since you stole my story.
See, if you're on the wiki, you would have known it was a story. Dude, you've got like 50 stories. How could you have stolen it?
I'm prepared.
Yeah, well, Alex stole one of my stories, so.
Yeah, but you said it was okay, so.
That's true.
This is about the Department of Transportation, so I'm assuming this means public roads.
But I thought that, and I only glossed over the story, but I thought it wasn't that, you know, you can now put a car on the road, but it's just that it's been authorized so they can develop laws or things pertaining to how
you are absolutely right. Uh-huh. You're absolutely right. It has to do with rules and regulations governing the use of them.
Because otherwise, I mean, that's pretty scary, you know? Like, I mean,
on the contrary, they've had them working in California, although they had a driver sitting in the car, well, but they weren't interacting with the car. The car was doing all the work.
Yeah.
Google
has said that those have been really successful, but I want someone other than just Google to say that they're
successful.
Actually,
there is.
You know?
Like, Toyota has been doing their own.
Oh, cool.
One of my other stories I was going to pair onto this was also Volkswagen has just recently showed off their own self-driving autopilot kind of cars.
That's
cool.
So
a lot of manufacturers are starting to get into this, and they, it's something I think we're going to see.
Right. Soon. And I do have to be honest. We said it in the show we were last talking about this, mm-hmm. is I think the cars will perform better than the average human being.
Oh, yeah.
But mm-hmm. the limitation is going to be, are the human beings going to accept their, you know, driverless perfect car record overlords?
You know, I actually think they might, given that people would love to do so many of the things while they're in the car. They already do.
You know,
let the car drive.
It's also we ignore in U.S. society we ignore how many fatalities there are in the road. Mm-hmm. And if we can produce a system where we can highlight, yeah, we can get rid of these fatalities, we're going to use it. I mean, it's just a.
But here's my fear, the system messes up once, and.
And that story gets
a ton of news. Right. Everyone gets scared of them, and no one wants
this
to use
them. This is what I was talking about.
So when you've got a really bad car, right, and you're in a parking lot, and all of a sudden it drives, you know, for no reason it drives you off an embankment. Something that a human being would never do, right? That would be the issue.
Or even just a normal accident still. You know, like if it was an accident where it was determined that the car that was being driven automatically was at fault, mm-hmm. even if it wasn't necessarily something that that car could have prevented.
Right.
You know, like.
Or that a human being could have avoided. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Not just that the software will malfunction, but maybe the software will perform at its best and there will be a Kobayashi Maru, Star Trek reference, no win scenario. You know, and
Except
then that'll
reprogram
get
the simulator.
Exactly. We're in the Matrix, right, Miles? That's okay. Anyway, that was my comment. Your story. The onus is on you to talk.
I don't think it'll be as bad as that. I think, if there is an accident, it may get a lot of press, but there are accidents with automated systems in trains and people still travel in trains. I mean, there are so many examples where things are automated that were not before.
But in trains, as a passenger, you're never really in control.
Yeah.
So it's a much easier environment to not have control in.
Yeah, trains are not autonomous. They do have an engineer. Even though the systems are automatic, there's always someone sitting in front that can override.
Yes, but failures are not always the person who's driving its fault. There are failures in the
This has nothing to do with the statistics of whether one is better than the other. This has to do with people's willingness to accept it. Never underestimate the power of people disliking technology. Look at cell phone statistics.
Another thing is, if you look at the news, you always hear about airplane accidents and you always hear about train accidents or train system accidents, you know? And I think it does have to do with whether or not you as a rider are in control of the situation. Plus, there's so many cars on the roads and so many accidents that's normal.
So
it never gets pressed.
And that's exactly the thing. You know, when an accident happens and a car accident happens and people die, you're like, well, there was somebody that was at fault. There's a human being that made a mistake.
Well, you hear about it every day, but in the morning news.
Right. But, I know. And I'm not saying you don't hear about it. You hear about it. But there's kind of this acceptance like, yeah, that can happen if a mistake happens.
But in a
plane or a train, you get that feeling of, well, I'm not in control at all. So whoever's doing this better be really good at it. And if there's a mistake in that system, then it's really concerning because you have given up your power and you've given it away to somebody else. So with these cars, it's going to be the same thing. You're going to give away your control, if you will.
Which is funny considering the fact that if you're in a car, on a freeway with hundreds of other people,
right.
you are absolutely not in control.
Right.
You are hoping and trusting that other people are going to be sufficiently skilled and healthy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
but it feels like you're in control. I think that's what matters to people.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I'm reminded of the news story I heard, I mean, this months and months ago about a train accident that occurred because the person who was in charge of, who was supposed to be conducting the train, was text messaging at the time.
Oh, no. Yeah. Of course, it's technology that caused the problem.
I don't know about that.
let's move on to Alex, it's your time. Your turn.
All right. I think Best Buy might want to sue GeekSpeak.
Oh.
I think there's some concerns about
it's our roaring success. Huh?
Best, yeah, yeah. well, okay, maybe
all
not.
The money we
they probably won't come after us. They probably won't come after us. However, they are going after a lot of companies over the word geek, which is, to me, like, just wrong on so many levels. They're going after a lot of companies that are, like, I guess kind of similar. They're
because
geek
they're
services.
Geek Squad that they've got?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because they have Geek Squad, they're kind of claiming ownership to the term geek in that context.
Interesting.
So they're going after companies like Geek House Calls, Rent-A-Geek, Geek Rescue, all these other companies
that's
that
ridiculous.
Are similar.
Yeah.
That's my opinion on that.
We have a nice trademark supporting the radio use of GeekSpeak. Actually, it's owned by somebody
David
else.
Lawrence,
yes. Yeah, should we mention?
Miles sure. The GeekSpeak is a registered trademark of David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use.
There you go. Service mark, though, not a trademark.
Service mark.
Because it's a service. But in any case, we've been using GeekSpeak for 13 years, KOSP has, but not in that context. That's totally right. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been being used by that context of getting help at your house with your technology. And I could see that if they have the service mark for, you know, using the word geek in a home service kind of work, I could see a reason why they might own that.
Well, we're in people's homes right now.
I don't. That kind of sounds to me very much like Facebook suing everyone that has the word book in it. It's just it's a little too generic.
It all has to do with what your trade is involved in and what the mark is.
Entrepreneur
right?
magazine's so if been your running at that.
If your trade specifically is to deliver coffee to the house and you've got the coffee mobile trademark, anybody that has those things and they're delivering coffee, there's a potential problem.
But coffee or mobile, just on their own?
Them together. And I think the issue is that Geek Squad's been around long enough doing that. Maybe no one else has been using the term geek in the home. The word geek for that.
I just don't buy that.
I mean, the definition of the word geek is to a search performer.
But if you had some company that was doing geek or coffee mobile to send door-to-door coffee, I don't know, something like that, and somebody was wanting to do that service, which is perfectly legal. They want to sell coffee door-to-door just like these other people. And they call it coffee to go or coffee to you.
Yeah.
The idea of trademarking
coffee
just seems, especially when it has a lot to do with what you're
dealing with. I would
agree.
Coffee's a very clear definition. Geek is not, however.
Oh, yes, it is.
No, we think of it that way.
No, but the reason why they chose. Commonly known. Yeah. It's been known since, in this context, since the 80s.
Yeah, the reason why they named it Geek Squad is because geek had that connotation of the nerd who knows about computers.
Yeah.
I mean, they
no,
took
I know
it
why
because
they
of the definition that was known to people.
Yeah.
Already.
I get that. I get that. And they're doing a trademark business about that kind of service. I think one of the problems that we see, if they were a Santa Cruz-based company doing Geek Squad, another shop showed up that was called Geek Delivery Service, there'd be a trademark issue. The reason why we find it so offensive is that it's international and they're taking that term. If it was a locally based system, I don't think you'd have much of a problem with it. One company in town being the Geek Store, what's the problem?
I think
with
we're
that?
Just being defensive because we're called GeekSpeak.
I sure. That's totally right. You're listening to GeekSpeak on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. I want to mention that GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. See, they don't call themselves Geek Squad.
Oh, that's a great argument.
That would be a problem because Geek Squad's actually the trademark.
Yeah. Anybody have a geek bit today? Short mention?
Sure. I can do just a couple of oft-repeated myths. That's something that, geeks are always into. Like, for example, the idea that the Great Wall of China is the only man-made object visible from space.
Mm.
Yeah, not true.
What else?
we use 10% of our brains. Not true.
Right. We use all of
our
brains.
Never has been. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Oh, I got one. Sorry, 90% of your heat escapes through your head because heat rises. No.
Not true.
Heated air rises. Heat radiates in all directions equally.
Nice.
So wear a hat.
Yeah. Wait, what?
Wait, yeah. Didn't I just counter what you just said?
No. If you wear a hat, if you don't wear a hat, then sure. If you're bundled up everywhere else, then yeah, 90% of your heat will escape through your head.
Okay.
Because you're bundled up.
Because nothing else leaves.
Cracking knuckles gives you arthritis. Shaving hair makes it grow back thicker.
This is all false.
These are all false. Absolutely false.
Although shaving, the first time you shave can make it appear to grow back thicker. It doesn't actually grow back thicker.
All right.
That Columbus.
What's the other objects you can see from space? And what is that definition?
No, you
from
can't
the moon?
See it from space.
You can't see it
no,
from space?
No, I believe you can. You can see there's multiple space. Things you can see. I believe you can also. Not, people not, have been able to pinpoint
the been
Hoover
frustrating
Dam.
To me.
The human eye.
Yes, with the human eye.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Have you been there?
You really want to go down this road with me, young man.
You can't see anything from space with the human eye alone.
You're right.
You
just because
brain,
you haven't seen
you
it
other things.
Doesn't mean it doesn't
and
exist.
And protective gear.
Oh, sorry. From the moon.
From the moon. Thank you. I was looking for a distance.
Right. But okay, you can't see the Great Wall of China from the moon.
Thank you.
With a human
thank
eye.
Thank you. Okay.
You sure?
There's more clarity.
Yes.
Unless it's a really
and also,
big human eye.
And also a very important one. Columbus did not believe that the world was round when most of the world didn't. Actually, most of the world knew that the world was round.
Right.
Back to ancient Greece.
Right.
And possibly earlier.
Cool. Thank you. That was a great little update. I'll mention, too, that GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. More information at cruise.io.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Alex, Ben, and Miles. It's Miles' birthday. If you'd like to call us and wish him a happy birthday, please just email us instead. We're going to have a guest on today. Brian, you've actually been quietly sitting at your computer not speaking to us, but you're still there, right, Brian?
Yes, I'm here.
Have you been enjoying the conversation? If you haven't, lie.
No, it's been good. I actually had one fun fact as well.
Oh, well, please.
You open the show talking about the mark of the beast being 666.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually 616.
So that just throws out everything we talked about in the beginning of the show.
Exactly.
Well, if you take 616 and you add the very popular number 50 to it, and then you do everything that I said.
So now I'm actually curious. Where did 666 come from? Was it just some?
Wait, where did 616 come from?
Mathematically dyslexic?
It's actually a mistranslation. They found some older documents and scrolls where it's actually 616, and then they found some later ones where it became 626, and then somewhere along the translation it became 666.
So it's evil inflation.
It's version numbering.
Brian Suda is an informatician living in Reykjavik, Iceland, and you talk a lot about data visualization, and you're really into the mobile space right now. It's hard, I found, to classify you very well into some area, and I think that has to do with you normally don't get to define jobs and skills and stuff until those things have become common, and you're kind of always in that beginning space where we don't have good definitions from it because you can't go to school right now and get a degree in it. Is that valid?
No, that's pretty close to it. I'm also trying to just go across lots of different verticals and different sort of knowledge silos to try and pull in a bit of psychology here, a bit of data visualization, a bit of mathematics, a bit of computer programming. And like I said, there's not really a word for kind of this jack of all trades, master of none kind of concept.
I think it's geek, actually.
Possibly.
But don't tell Best Buy
that. Actually, isn't this the what's called a polymath?
If you're good at it.
So, Brian, will you tell me a little bit about traditional data visualization has been done with whatever you can do with Excel, right? Bar charts, pie charts, things of that nature. We learn in school some data visualization tools just to understand graphs, which we use quite a bit. And what does a graph give you that straight numbers doesn't?
Well, I guess it all depends. A lot of it is the sort of overly used thing of a picture is worth 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you do these sort of bar charts, you can get a lot of interrelation. I mean, maybe you'd see a table that says, 96% to 4%, and you can read it, but you don't really understand the weight of the distance of those two numbers until you see it, visualized in some way.
Tell us about Apple's recent visualization technique, I guess it's kind of old at this point, where they use 3D in an interesting way.
Yeah, it was about a year after the iPhone came out. They had a nice – Steve Jobs is on stage, and he had a nice little pie chart where he was showing off the growth figures for how well the iPhone was. And it's a really sneaky thing if you use these sort of 3D charts and graphs. People don't understand perspective that well. And as you draw perspective off in the distance, buildings that are actually the same height have to look smaller because you're making 3D in a 2D space. So in the presentation, Steve Jobs is up there on stage talking about how great the sales of the iPhone were. And then he was using some fancy 3D pie chart. And of course, in the front is the iPhone numbers. So it looks overly big and distorted. And it was, I would venture to guess that they were doing this on purpose.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting thing because, of course, what he's using is Keynote, an application they sell, which is actually pretty good. And it's a out-of-the-box, really simple thing to do to make a pie chart. And when we talk about 3D, basically imagine a normal pie from above and then just tilt the back of it away from you, the top of it away from you. And what happens, of course, is from a three-dimensional, from a perspective base, is the pie pieces in the front just look bigger. I mean, they take more screen real estate, if you will. To a brain that processes 3D information really well, like ours, it actually, we understand at some level that those pie pieces are not smaller that are in the back. And it's interesting how well our brain uses these. So I can argue it the other direction as well. But what was really curious is that he didn't have the Apple stuff in the back, you know? And what showed up on that pie chart, of course, is that the Apple iPhone share, if you will, was a smaller percentage than other, this very large group. And actually, I think a large percentage of other was one other manufacturer, Microsoft's. And so there was a lot of data hidden there.
I think though, even like you said, our brain is pretty good at, you know, getting 3D objects and spatial dimensions. Still, every little bit that you can edge out, maybe psychologically,
absolutely,
maybe just tricks, it all helps.
What also is the color thing, right? We don't normally see large blocks of color in perspective space, right? So color is another thing. If you take a certain screen size and you fill it by percentages of color, you'll notice that in a different part of your brain than the three-dimensional space analysis. So what the other thing was going on is the other section that he was trying to kind of obscure, assuming they were doing this intentionally, we don't really know. That was one color, and the Apple iPhone was a different color. And so from just a pixel count, there was more of the Apple iPhone color than the other, even though the other pie was larger. Really interesting kind of talking about this, because, of course, you're not just talking about – oh, you're going?
I was going to say just the color aspect, the newest version of the MacBooks around the monitor itself, it's all a black border, as opposed to the old ones where it was the metallic silver border. Mm-hmm. And the simple thing for that is the colors will look a lot brighter on the screen next to black than they would next to the shinier white silver. Now, so I think they're doing a lot intentionally. They know what they're doing.
Well, they're designers. They're very good designers. The thing that's interesting to me is that the feeling of it being brighter is something you want your customer to have, right? So to some degree, you can just say, well, it's a better experience for the customer. We're not trying to pretend that it's brighter than it actually is. We're just trying to give a better experience for the user. And isn't that what good design is? So the idea of tricking your brain isn't – that's what design's about.
Yeah, I think there's probably a very thin line of ethics in there. But this one, I would agree with you. I think if you want to make the user happy, if that's your end goal, certainly you want to make things pop. You want to make it a better experience overall.
To be clear, what we're talking about is the MacBook Pros, MacBooks that Apple sells for a while. The screen, the LCD screen, that's the actual top that opens and closes. It doesn't fill the entire area. There's some space around the side for the other electronics and things. And that space used to be silver, the same color. Well, it used to be the same color of the machine that you're getting. If it was a white machine, it would be white. And now it's always black. And you'll notice that on most of them. When you see that, if you look at that kind of thing, you notice that kind of thing, you're doing that thing that geeks do, I think, that idea that you're analyzing the why about everything, especially about stuff that's designed. You know, why is it that this board that's from the 80s that's in front of me that's mixing the sound, why does it have a wood enclosure about it? You know, because at the time of this making it, that was nice and quality and classy. And I personally really like it. I'm going to miss it when we replace it. But anyway, let's go on. Ben, you saw you went to At Media, and Brian spoke.
Yes. Yeah. I went to At Media in London. It's a conference, and saw a number of speakers. And Brian gave a talk on visualizing data, actually, on this very topic, and it was really fantastic.
So, what interests you about it, Ben? What is it that is intriguing about this idea of visualizing data?
I think, as geeks, I think we all are very oftentimes trying to communicate things that are difficult to communicate, right? Either large amounts of data or complex concepts. And what makes some of us better teachers is that some of us can find ways of presenting that information to people who don't have a context to understand it. Mm-hmm. And I think that visualizing data is very similar. You know, like if you're getting petabytes of information from the LHC or something like that, the Large Hadron Collider, how are you going to visualize that to people who don't know how to read that statistically or whatever?
Yeah.
You know?
Brian, would you assume, do you like this kind of premise that we are story-based people, creatures, and go on.
No, I was going to say, I think you're spot on with that. I think it's incredibly important that we need to pick, you know, the story in the data and kind of slice it that way. Because if you just give someone, like you said, 15 petabytes of raw data, I mean, you wouldn't even know where to begin or where to start or what these numbers even mean.
Yeah. I have early experience in the web environment. I was working for a company. We were doing millions of dollars with AOL. And AOL basically put banners all over AOL's site, and people would click on them and come to our site, and then we'd try to sell them something. And that process, we collected a lot of data about the marketing packages we were using, about the type of user, how many browsers they had, all these different stuff, how long they stayed with our site, how long they read each page. This is a very traditional, I think every geek in the room's kind of experienced this. You know, we want to see this data. And this idea of being a person that can create that for them, you create numbers, I can make a pie chart if you want, but I need to know what question you're asking, what story you want told, because it's not possible to show all of this data. There's too much.
Well, depending on how you visualize some things too, different types of visualization help communicate the idea much more rapidly. I mean, for me, you know, if I go to my boss and I give him an Excel spreadsheet with a bunch of data, he's going to look at this and say, okay, thanks, and he's going to toss it aside, never even think about it. But if I give him something with a graph showing the ideas that I'm trying to communicate by that data, it makes more sense. Or if I, for example, I'm processing firewall data and I go and populate, you know, real-time processing of the latest firewall data and geographing it, you know, putting little dots on a map, he instantly goes, why are we doing something in Russia? You know, I mean, he instantly understands what this data is telling him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's important too, that just the whole... the different types of visualizations are communicate things differently and more quickly.
Brian, isn't that one of those core first problems with data visualization, is trying to figure out what you're trying to say even before trying to visualize? Or is there an earlier step?
I think that's probably one of the first things you need to do is ask the question, you know, what is it that I'm looking for? I mean, if you think of it like just any sort of journalist, you know, the journalist who's going to sit down and write a story, before they can write, you know, any political story or business story, they're like, what is the goal? What do I want to dig into? And then go find those facts, get the information, and dig it out. It's the same with numbers. You know, you've got, like you said, server logs. You know, before you just crunch all those, you want to say, okay, am I looking for time on the site, number of instances of, you know, people clicking through to a certain page, or the flow for a purchase checkout.
Mm-hmm.
A good example I used in the slides is just a simple bar chart. You know, I had 12 months of the year and, you know, three divisions in a company, you know, the red team, the blue team, and the black team. And you could see on a month-by-month basis how each team was doing in sales.
Okay.
But you can take that exact same data and convert it from a bar chart just to a stacked bar chart. And now you can see the company as a whole, how it's doing each month.
Right.
So using the exact same data, we get two completely different stories.
Right. One is a kind of a competitive story, and one is more of a this is how people work together story.
Right. And it's using the exact same data. So I think that's a very key thing you need to do. The first step is to sort of find out what is it that, you know, my boss or my customers or someone in the company wants to find out.
Let's analyze that again. I just want to be really clear for people. So if you show your graph is 1 month, let's say it's May, and you look at how many laughs Ben got versus Miles versus Alex on GeekSpeak, you could have three different bars, each of them labeled, and you'd see how well they did.
That I am far more hilarious than you are.
Yes. I wasn't in that bar chart.
It's only because you're deprecating about Lyle's humor.
It's easy to get laughs if you make fun of me. So,
especially if you're talking about your humor.
That's right. We're lack thereof. Moving on. So you can analyze GeekSpeak that way. If you do it that way, of course, you're looking at this competitive aspect, which is only interesting maybe to, you know, one up men and find out who buys the beer. But if you then go to, not that we ever never analyze ourselves, but
there's been beer this time.
Not for you, you're too
I've never had any.
So ooh, one for me. I'm on the bar chart now. Okay, so the other way to do this is you show the entire year a bar for every month, and instead of showing the three geeks separated out, you just stack them on top of each other. And what that does, you might still see a higher indice of Miles having more laughs, but you'll see how funny the shows are for the month. That's the – I'm just trying to give a – trying to help people visualize that.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's not – that's really about – even though this exact same data – in fact, the exact same numbers are being presented, it really has to do with what you're trying to – I hate to use the marketing term, but to some degree it's a marketing term – what you're trying to sell to your audience.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's – like we've been discussing, that the first thing you need to do is sit down and decide what is the story we want to tell, because that will define the way you go about using the data, the way you visualize the data, the way you think about it, and maybe even what you need to go out and collect.
A couple weeks ago, we did a show about copyright. And one of the projects that I ran across in your work that I thought was really interesting was TwitCC. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I teamed up with Andy Clark, based out of the UK, and he was working on a book, and he wanted to include a bunch of, I guess, tweets and Twitter icons and avatars. But his book publisher said, the only way we can do this is if the people have given us permission. Now, I know there's a lot of sort of discussion about, is a tweet copyrightable in the first place? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say no. I think a lot of non-lawyers say yes or no, but they're not lawyers. And at the end of the day, if someone with pretty deep pockets wanted to challenge you, you know, that's their prerogative. So TweetCC was set up with the intention that people could just send a message at TweetCC. I, you know, give up my tweets to this Creative Commons license or public domain. And we would just archive that. So that way, when Andy or anyone wanted to write a book or use your tweets in maybe on a t-shirt or something like that, they could just reference it and say, oh, this person has already given me permission. We don't necessarily need to, you know, contact them. And we're kind of that kind of clearinghouse to hold that declarations.
Has Twitter added this ability inside their system to say what kind of license your work is?
No, because Twitter themselves doesn't claim copyright over your tweets. Unlike some of the other social networks, they don't try. They just say, it's yours. You can do what you want with it.
Well, I meant more the idea that couldn't Twitter just have something on your profile that said what kind of copyright your work is so that you wouldn't have to have a secondary service? It's really interesting that you had to build a secondary service.
It's certainly conceivable. I mean, they have verified accounts, so they could put up little other icons that say this person is releasing theirs under Creative Commons or something like that.
Right.
Maybe it's just send them a support request, feature request.
You talked about this in your talk that I was looking at about TwitCC in the whole context of a hacking conference. Can you tell us a little bit about the hacking? As in good, we normally talk about security vulnerabilities and cracking and the whole thing with the Sony's space being hacked. Can you tell us about the good connotation of hack in the geek community?
Sure. I'm hacking all day long. Basically, what I'm doing is taking lots of disparate kind of sources of data or sources of information and smashing them all together and building something interesting on top of it. Sometimes it's called a mashup, but just generally when you hack about, you're kind of producing something that either no one had thought of or it might have been a little difficult to do. And then you piece it together and you build something else on top of it.
Okay. I mean, I get that. I'm just always trying to – more about the feeling of it. Like you – in talking to a group of people that does this kind of thing, you do it – we talk about it in this kind of joyous way. What is it about that's joyous?
Oh, yeah. It's very empowering to be able to take something. Like I said, yeah, it's empowering to be able to know. I mean, as a programmer, I think it's a great – I mean, that's something that probably no generation really before us has been able to, you know, take up some tools, digital tools in their own hands and build something incredibly beautiful or simple for almost no cost.
Can you give me an example of something you're working on now?
What I've been doing a lot, I really enjoy this sort of, deterministic design. I'm really big on like smart defaults because I deal with large data sets. It's impossible for me to sit down and create a sort of infographic or beautiful visualization because the data that's going to flow into this visualization every day could change, or it could be millions of documents or things you couldn't possibly sit down and curate. Mm-hmm. The social network Doppler is a good example. They had probably hundreds of thousands of cities, and they wanted to give a unique color for each city. It's impossible to sit down and, you know, dole out a hex color for every city. So they came up with this really quirky, simple algorithm where they just took an MD5 hash of the string. So that would produce a big, long...
the city name.
Correct. So you could do something like San Francisco, and that will run that through MD5, just a mathematical function, and it gives you a 32-character hex string. And this is guaranteed to be unique. Every system will generate the same number, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a good starting point. Then they just took the first six characters, and that was a web-safe hex color. Right. Not web-safe, just a hex color for the web. So they came up with an algorithm that would automatically assign a color to any string.
Right.
So you could feed your name in, you geek speak.
When you get nasty colors?
Sometimes you do, but that's, you know, you take the good with the bad sometimes.
Yeah,
and that's where you have to build in lots of smart defaults. So in the case of city names, which might have been very light in color, you'd have to find another algorithm to always write black text on top of very light colors. Whereas if it's producing very dark, muddy colors, you want to make sure you're using white text on top of that. So it's just a matter of a lot of smart defaults in this sort of deterministic design.
So that instead of giving people a random or a pseudo-random background color, but then always a black text, and they have to fix it afterward, you're actually detecting that, then giving them a good default base. I get that. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. So these are the sort of little quirky, you know, I mean, think of the old MySpace days where people could upload maybe any background image and then put neon green text on top of it.
Right.
I mean, a quick hack might be to count all of the pixels in the background image they uploaded, find out the most common one. Is it a light color? Is it a dark color? Use the opposite text on the page for that.
Right. Even though if you've got a scrambled background, there's pretty much
so
no
yeah, way these are the sort of yeah. projects. Yeah, that might not be the best example, but there are like I said, these sort of deterministic design. I'm always hacking together lots of interesting little projects. There was an interesting one I saw. I think it's a city in Norway, and they had this really beautiful kind of gem icon, and every day the little gem would kind of morph or change a little bit. And I never realized what it was until months later that it was the wind direction for that town.
Cool.
So the town's logo was based on the weather. So it was really interesting. And I thought, this is pretty cool. This is pretty simple. So I went and grabbed the weather data for the closest weather station to my house and just wrote a quick little PHP script to generate a wind diagram. So now I can mimic, you know, what these guys probably spent an ad agency, thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, little weekend side project, little hack. And I've got myself a similar thing.
We're speaking with Brian Suda. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room is Miles, Ben, and Alex. We are taking calls. If you've got questions for Brian about data visualization and the stuff he does, please feel free to give us a call. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And Brian Suda can be found. You can find him from geekspeak.org. But it's Suda, SUDA.co.uk. Now, you've got a UK domain name. Why?
When I grew up in St. Louis, and then I moved to Scotland when I was going to school there. I was up at the University of Edinburgh, and I had registered the domain at that point in time thinking, yeah, this is going to be the future. This is where I'm going to be staying. And yeah, after the bubble, it became quite difficult for someone with a US passport to stick around in the EU and find work. So yeah, I was slowly making my way back to the US, and I've stuck over in Iceland, and I've been there close to 5 years now. So yeah, the co.uk website makes things quite confusing.
I find it interesting that this idea that domains were specifically designed kind of to have this, the location base, or they've grown to have location base around them, but now they're not like that at all. They're really just whatever's convenient for the user. And that identity that you've taken on will be your identity for the rest of your life, wouldn't you assume?
Oh yeah, that's the other problem is I've probably got so many inbound links now to the .co.uk website. And, you know, I've got web services that people can use through the website. So I kind of need to keep it up. And like you said, it's become part of my identity, all sorts of little footers here and there link back to the site. So it would be quite painful, Google juice wise, you know, let alone, you know, other people just knowing me at that website. So yeah, I just got to kind of keep it and keep it going. And who knows, maybe one day I'll be back in the UK.
Right. All right, we get a call from Morgan Hill. Arthur, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, let's try that again. Arthur, welcome to GeekSpeak. No. Okay. Well, it was fun having Dial Tone join the show today. maybe we're having trouble with the system.
It's got a personality.
But we're running out of time anyway, so I guess I'll say no to the phone calls at this point. And go ahead and ask any of the geeks get a question for Brian. Or Brian, did you have a story you want to tell us quickly before we finish up the show?
Well, I had just a quick thing to mention. I was thinking, I can't really think of a good way to phrase it into a question. So I guess Brian, you know, just jump in. However, but how can we avoid confirmation bias? Right, if we're able to weave a story with pretty much any data set we want, right? I mean, you know, you can take the iPhone, you know, growth numbers and everything as compared to all the other companies, and you can make any one of those companies look like it's doing really, really well, or any of the companies make it look like they're not doing very well, you know? So I think it's an interesting line to walk kind of between what stories are too much in the marketing realm, what stories are on the other side of that line and are being deceptive.
I think that's exactly right. I think when I was a bit younger, probably a bit more naive, I was facts, you know, it's a fact. You know, he sold this many units. How could, mm-hmm. how could you possibly deceive anyone with facts? You know, a table of information, you know, how could that possibly lie? But, you know, like you've said, the way you display it, you know, or sometimes the information that you don't put in can be just as sort of biasing to the result. I guess that's sort of, both, you know, a journalist has some sort of code of ethics where they try and write an unbiased story or try and write both sides of the story. I think the same is going to have to be for any sort of visualizations and graphic design. You know, you are there to, you know, tell a story and it should be as unbiased as possible. But as a reader, we should be aware that, yeah, you can be deceived and can be tricked.
And what are some of the most popular ways that, that companies or groups can trick?
Well, I think more for that information, you'll have to go check out more of what Brian does. You can find Brian Sudo online, of course, from geekspeak.org. We'll link to your Twitter and all that. And following him will give you a good glimpse to this kind of topic quite well. I'm looking forward to reading more about what you produce and share. Thank you, Brian, for being on GeekSpeak.
Thank you.
Transition Santa Cruz announces Urban Garden Share Santa Cruz, a website to help people create community through backyard gardens. You can share a garden with someone in your neighborhood and eat fresh local food grown right aside your front door. The urbangardenshare.org/Santa Cruz. urbangardenshare.org/Santa Cruz. GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Monterey County Atheists, a secular community group hosting monthly meeting July 8th. At 7 p.m. at Mountain Mike's Pizza in Marina. Information is online at meetup.com/MCAtheists. Monterey County Atheists, promoting secular public values. GeekSpeak on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Thank you, geeks, for being here today with me. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up next is Car Talk with Click and Clack. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.